Imes kocher Yerushalayim Tishkach yemini Imes kocher Yerushalayim Yemini Im lo yamet Yerushalayim Al Adonai Simchasi Im lo yamet Yerushalayim Al Adonai Simchasi Tidiro
Vayidaber Adonai el Moshe Behar Sinai Lemor Daber el Bnei Yisrael Vyomarta Alehem Ki Savau el Haaretz Asher Ani Nosein Lachem Vishavisa Haaretz Shabbos Ladonai. And God spoke to Moshe on Har Sinai, saying, speak to the people of Israel, and tell them when they arrive in the land of Israel, which I am giving them, they shall rest the land a Shabbat to God. The Torah continues, 6 years they shall plant their field, and 6 years they shall work their vineyards and reap their harvest. On the seventh year, Shabbat Shabbaton Yihyeh La'aretz, it shall be a Shabbat for the land, a Shabbat for God. Sadecha lo tizra, the field should not be planted, and the vineyard shall not be harvested. And further details continue. We'll have more of that shortly.
OU Israel presents
Come in. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for the double portion, Behar Bechukotai, and it's also for Yom Yerushalayim coming around next Wednesday, since my next show, Amir Tzashem, will be after Yom Yerushalayim. Recording and first availability, Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the 22nd day of Iyar 5777, corresponding this year to May 18. Without further ado, let us do Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Psalm 130. Shir Hama'alot Mima'amakim Karaticha Adonai. Adonai Shimavakoli Tihyena Aznecha Kashuvot L'kol Tachanunai. Im avono tishmor yah Adonai miya amod, ki imcha haslicha lema'an tivare, ki viti Adonai kiveta nafshi velidvaro hochalti, nafshi l'Adonai mi shomerim laboker, shomerim laboker, yachel Yisrael el Adonai ki im Adonai hachesed v'harbe imo fedut, v'hu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. אחינו כל בית ישראל, הנתונים בצרה ובשביה, העומדים בין בים ובין ביבשה, המקום ירחם עליהם ויוציאם מצרה לרווחה, ומאפלה לאורה ומשיבוד לגאולה, השתה בעגלה ובזמן קריב, ונאמר אמן. Okay, let's get down to business, and let me start with a very famous Rashi question, and it will dovetail the Parsha of Behar and Bechukotai into Yom Yerushalayim, what's coming up. I don't really know at this moment the best way to start, so let me take a step back and start it a different way and hope that this works. We are in the midst of the counting of the Omer. Last night, we counted 37, which is 5 weeks and 2 days. 5 weeks out of 7 weeks, we're towards the end of the counting already. Many people ended the mournful part of the Omer with Lag BaOmer, and others started later and continue until Rosh Chodesh, Sivan, which is next Friday, or the days, the 3 days right before Shavuot. And that's not the point. The point is that the Omer period in the time of the Beit HaMikdash, past and future, is a, let's call it a semi-festive period, because it starts with Pesach and with the barley offering on the second day of Pesach and culminates with Shavuot and the double loaf, two loaves, wheat offering on Shavuot, and the counting in between is part of a package deal. Additionally, we're counting from the Exodus to the Sinai experience of Matan Torah, and it makes sense that this period should be joyous. However, as I've said a couple of times already during this period, the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash and the long exile into which the people of Israel was plunged took away the joy of the period, left the counting hollow. Count from after the bringing of the barley offering, but we don't have a barley offering today, until after 49 days, until the 50th day, when we have the two loaf offering called Mincha Chadasha Lashem, but we don't have that. So why are we counting? So some want to say we're counting just commemorative of the Beit HaMikdash, and this is echoed by the sentence which many people say right after counting each night, Horachaman, may the merciful one, Yachazir lanu, Beit Avodat Beit HaMikdash, may the merciful one restore the service of the temple to us, Bimheira v'yameinu, speedily in our time, Amen Selah. There is an opinion that the mitzvah to count still retains its Torah flavor, its Torah obligation. But either way, we can't avoid the overall melancholy feeling of the Omer period because of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. I said before, mournful. It's sort of token mournful, and melancholy, I think, does a better job. In the time of the Geula Shlema, the final and complete redemption, and the coming of the Mashiach and the building of the Beit HaMikdash, the period will return to what it was and what it's supposed to be. In the meantime, we've got bright spots within the darkish period. Even on an objective level, among the 49 days are 7 Shabbatot. And Shabbat is not a day for mourning. So let's call Shabbat, seven of them, a bright spot. Rosh Chodesh, there are 3 2-days Rosh Chodesh Iyar, 1 day Rosh Chodesh Sivan. There is the 14th of Iyar, which is Pesach Sheni, which we won't get into now. The biggie is Lag BaOmer, which originally was a respite within the slightly mournful period. Mildly mournful, maybe that's a better term. And this was a mild Simcha day when weddings could take place and people can shave and take haircuts and listen to music. And then along the way, quite a while back, Lag BaOmer, especially the eve of Lag BaOmer, mushroomed and exploded into a joyous celebration of the life of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, about his attitude that death is merely a transition into a better world, which he didn't invent that idea, but he was very strong on it. And basically, he is the father of that area of Torah study, which is called Sod, secret, Kabbalistic, the Zohar, and became a cause for great celebration, mostly in the Hasidic world, but it had its spreading effect on many other groups of Jews as well. But the essence is a joyful celebration of Torah, deep Torah, within a mournful period, a bright spot. Lag BaOmer was already, so we're not going to get into that more. Yom HaAtzmaut also was already, but we will get into it a little. Because, so now let me take another step back or up or sideways, whatever. The mindset that many Jews have, that Pesach is Zman Chirutenu, the time of our freedom, and Shavuot, which we call Zman Matan Toratenu, the time of the giving of the Torah, that description limits what is really happening here, because Shavuot is not only Zman Matan Toratenu, it is also a celebration of coming to Eretz Yisrael and building the Beit HaMikdash. Shavuot is called in the Torah, by the Torah, Yom HaBikurim, the day of the first fruits. It's the beginning of the season for bringing first fruits to the Beit HaMikdash. The recitation of a person bringing his Bikurim to the Beit HaMikdash is borrowed from the Torah and from the Bikurim reciter for use at our Pesach Seder. So all of a sudden, not all of a sudden, but way back on Pesach, we are already focused not just towards Shavuot with the receiving of the Torah and, in essence, our official nationhood as God's nation, but we are also focused on Shavuot of the coming into Eretz Yisrael and the building of the Beit HaMikdash. To put it in the terms of Dayenu song, the last few Dayenus, our Ilu Kervanu Lifnei Har Sinai, had you just brought us near Mount Sinai, Velo Natan Lanu Et HaTorah Dayenu, we would have sufficient cause to say thank you to God in that respect. Ilu Natan Lanu Et HaTorah, even had you given us the Torah, Velo Hichnisanu LeEretz Yisrael, and not brought us in to the land of Israel, Dayenu. Dayenu never means It's enough. Dayenu means it's sufficient reason to say thank you to God. So the receiving of the Torah certainly by itself is a cause for our saying thank you to God. But ilu hichnisanu le'eretz Yisrael v'lo vana lanu et beit ha-bechira, had you just taken us into Israel and not built the Beit HaMikdash, we would have sufficient reason to thank you. Apparently, it means more than the reason we had for Matan Torah, more than we had when we received the Shabbat, more than when the sea split, more than when we came out of Egypt. It's an increasing list of appreciation points for God, and the culmination is building the Beit HaMikdash. So I, in this week's printed Torah tidbits, suggested a line in Dayenu 14 and a half, which says, if you had just, now this is after coming to Eretz Yisrael, and after receiving statehood, and 19 years later, the war that was supposed to wipe Israel off the map and drive all of the Jews into the sea. Miraculous victory in 6 days. So, had you not helped IDF with this amazing victory over the Arabs that were intent on killing us, and not... And brought Jerusalem and other parts of Eretz Yisrael back into our hands, but not yet build the Beit HaMikdash, we would have sufficient cause to say thank you. In other words, my point is the period of the Omer did not shut down completely on our festive feeling. It, as I said, became melancholy, and it also has its bright spots to say, look what the future holds for us. Yes, Hakamat HaMedina, establishment of the State of Israel, is something to say thank you for now, but it is a major, significant step in the direction of the final Geula. Yes, the victory of the Six-Day War and the reunification of Jerusalem is cause for saying thank you to God now, but it also is a major step pointing towards the Geula Shlema. And, by the way, in that same vein, that's Lag BaOmer, a celebration of a life of a person within the period that we are mourning the deaths of people is a positive thing in and of itself, and it points towards the future. So, not just Yom HaTzmaut and Yom Yerushalayim, but many things that happen during the Omer. I'll go back to either Rosh Chodesh or Pesach Sheni, they are all joyous occasions in the time of the Beit HaMikdash. They are all reduced to commemorative nature in our time without a Beit HaMikdash, and they will be restored to the joy of the time of the Beit HaMikdash when we are privileged to have that. Now I want to reflect on the opening song, which was Im Eshkachech Yerushalayim, and then also on the Shemitah and Har Sinai question. The stories by now are classic and maybe apocryphal, but they are potent. The one is the woman in Chutz La'aretz, in a comfortable home, in a comfortable lifestyle, celebrating the Pesach Seder, actually celebrating two Pesach Seders with family and friends and wonderful possessions of silver and china and crystal. And then towards the end of the Seder, when everybody bursts into song of Lashon HaBa B'Yerushalayim HaBenuya, next year in rebuilt Jerusalem, the woman of the house started to cry. And her husband said, "What's the matter, dear?" And she said, "Next year in Jerusalem, I don't want to leave the lifestyle that I have here. I don't want to leave my friends and everything else that we have built up over these years. I like it here." To which the husband said, "Don't worry, dear, it's only a song." Well, I got to tell you, it's not only a song. And neither is Im Eshkachech Yerushalayim, and Lashon HaBa B'Yerushalayim, and V'il Yerushalayim Ircha Barachamim Tashuv. No matter how many beautiful melodies those words have been put to, they are not just song. They are the heart and soul of the Jewish people longing for the Geula. So now, let me take it a step further. My first trip to Israel as a young lad of 14 was in the summer of 1962. If you want to count backwards, I was born 3 days before the State of Israel was established, which is probably why my name is Pinchas and Philip instead of Israel. In any event, when I was 14, my family came to Israel, and we went on Tisha B'Av to the sort of closest place one could get to the Old City and to the Kotel and to Har HaBayit, and that was Har Tzion, Mount Zion. And I remember hearing Eicha read in a cave-like setting on Har Tzion, and you felt the lack of access to Yerushalayim, the Old City. Before we went into that cave, a guide who was around pointed in the distance and said, "You see that red roof next to the antenna? Go a little bit to the right and a little bit further. That's where the Kotel is." In that summer, I saw a barbed wire cut through Yerushalayim. I saw a large wall on Rehov Agron, down the block from the new and first Supersol. I saw no man's land behind the King David Hotel. I saw a convoy going from Jerusalem that we held to Mount Scopus via the Mandelbaum Gate, and was imbued by the feeling of a broken Jerusalem. The next time I came was in 1969, 2 years after Milchemet Sheshet Hayamim, and I was a madrich of a group of high school kids through Mizrahi Hatzair, which doesn't exist anymore. We had some NCSY kids with us as well, and I'm sure a few B'nai Akivaniks too. And I took the group to Har Tzion for the reading of Eicha, depriving them of the Kotel, which we had access to, because I wanted them to feel what it was like before 1967. Then we went to the Kotel for Mincha of Tisha B'Av, Nachem, comfort, coming in, and that's how the Kotel at that point was to us. I'm not going to go into the previous Friday when we made our first visit to the Kotel and how I could not get myself to go near it, let alone touch it. I saw it for the first time, and at the beginning, that's all I wanted to do. And it took me till Tisha B'Av afternoon to actually go to the Kotel and touch it. And it's a feeling I'll never forget. Now, fast forward to 20 years ago, a little more maybe. I'm sitting in my office at the OU Israel Center on Rehov Strauss, and a Hasidish fellow comes in, sort of surprised me. We don't usually attract Hasidish guys. His name is Yossi Elbaum, and he was involved, maybe he was the head, of an organization, Lekinun HaMikdash, which was very much forward-facing towards the next Beit HaMikdash. And they were basically Hebrew-speaking organization, and he was looking for an outlet for English language, which the Israel Center is perfect for, to be able to present his thing. In conversation, he casually mentioned that the day before, when he was on Har HaBayit, the Temple Mount, such and such happened. And I gave him this look about, you were on the Temple Mount yesterday? He says, yeah, I go at least once a week. I said, but how could you if you're not allowed? He took the challenge. I was ignorant in those days. We went next door to my office, which was the library, and we sat down for half an hour learning through various sources, including Rambam. And lo and behold, I learned that ascending some of Har HaBayit in our time is permitted under certain circumstances. There are parts of Har HaBayit that are off limits until we have the ability to become purified from ritual defilement to a dead body, which requires the potion made of the ashes of the red heifer. But there are parts of Har HaBayit where the Beit HaMikdash did not stand, and where we can go after mikveh and with certain restrictions. I can't say to cut the story short because it's too late for that, but I will say that once I spoke to some of the people he told me who are regular visitors to Har HaBayit, and I checked with them, I started to itch. And I said, when I couldn't get to the Kotel, but I could get to Eretz Yisrael, and I could get to part of Yerushalayim, then the best I could do was somebody pointing in the direction of where the Kotel was. Once I was allowed to get to the Kotel, then it's not enough anymore to point in that direction. You need to stand at the Kotel, to daven at the Kotel, to kiss the Kotel, and to emote. But now, once I was told that halacha permits going on to Har HaBayit in certain places, then being at the Kotel wasn't enough. And I went on to Har HaBayit. It was a period of time that I had gone 6 different times. The first time I went with Rabbi Nachman Kahana, who took me around privately. And it was an amazing experience. And I had the opportunity on one of the visits to tear Kriya with Shem and Malchut, when I saw the place of the courtyard of the Beit HaMikdash, where the Mizbeach, the atoning altar stood. And I had an opportunity to cry when I saw the prophecy of foxes running through the decimated Har HaBayit, because I saw Arab kids playing soccer, kicking a ball right in the area that was the courtyard of the Beit HaMikdash, where the Mizbeach stood. And I cried. This is the feeling that I plug into the story with the song. There were long periods in Jewish history where coming back to Eretz Yisrael, I don't think was ever impossible, but was extremely difficult. And many, many Jews throughout the diaspora had to suffice with Im Eshkachech Yerushalayim Tishkach Yemini, had to suffice with Lashana Haba B'Yerushalayim HaBenuya, had to suffice with a picture of the Beit HaMikdash or Har HaBayit or the Kotel and some appropriate wording on it hanging in their living room to remind themselves that there is more than the life that they currently had. When it became possible and easier to come to live in Eretz Yisrael, then I have no sympathy, or not much sympathy, for the woman who cried when her family was singing Lashon Haba B'Yerushalayim HaBenuya, and for her husband that stupidly said, "Don't worry, dear, it's just a song." I mentioned much earlier that there's another famous story, apocryphal, of a husband, wife, and a son. The husband, the father, was a sea captain, a ship's captain, and he was away for long periods of time and would be home just briefly between voyages. The mother, his wife, the kid's mother, wanted to keep the memory of the father, the presence of the father, the being of the father, alive with the child. So she had a very good picture of him framed near the bedside of the child, and each night she would try to tell him something about his father, and they would say Shema, Kriyat Shema Lamita, and he would take the framed picture and kiss it and say, "Good night, Daddy. I hope to see you someday soon." It went on day after day, week after week, for months. And finally, the father slash husband comes home. And the father goes into the boy's room and tells him some stories of his voyage. And they say Shema. And the child picks up the picture and gives it a kiss and says, "Good night, Daddy. I hope to see you soon." And there, in the room with him, sitting on the edge of his bed, was his father that he longed for. Get the point? Lashana Haba B'Yerushalayim HaBenuya is a prayer for the future. Rebuild Jerusalem with the Beit HaMikdash. Lashana Haba B'Yerushalayim is something that a person should say, "Okay, I'm saying Lashana Haba B'Yerushalayim this year, but next year I will say Lashana Hazot this year in Yerushalayim. Here I am." It is an amazing feeling, and it's something for some of us that never ever gets old and wears out. I am here more than 35 years, going on 36 years, quite a while ago, not quite, but, you know, a short while ago, I passed my 50-50 point, and I have never, ever tired of the feeling, the emotion, the knowledge, brain, heart, and soul, that I am privileged to live in Eretz Yisrael and in Yerushalayim. And it is something that many of my friends also felt that way and came. Some of my friends felt that way and have not yet come. And some of my friends, I don't know why, but they don't seem to ever have felt that way. And not only are they not coming, they're not thinking of coming. And that, to me, is very problematic. Which brings us now, in a long way, to the question of Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe Bahar Sinai Lemor, and what specifically follows that verse, the laws of coming to Eretz Yisrael and observing Shemitah, and of counting to Yovel, and of observing Yovel. The question has many different ways of answering. But I want to look at the question as, how can you even ask that question? Ma inyan Shemitah Eitzel Har Sinai? Shemitah Eitzel Har Sinai, juxtaposing Mount Sinai, where we got the Torah, to Shemitah, which is a mitzvah that has to do with the land, is exactly the microcosm, maybe it's even more than that, of the goal of the Jewish people as set down by God, and the fulfillment of Ritzon Hashem, the will of God. I've said this many times, I'll say it again. Right, originally up front, first communication by God to Moshe Rabbeinu, the greatest of all prophets. They met at a burning bush. And at that bush, God said, I have remembered my promises to the patriarchs. I have heard the cries of the people of Israel. And I, says God, will descend there to take them up to a land, a goodly and expansive land, a land flowing with milk and honey. First time that was ever said. Shemot chapter 3, verse 8. The land of the Canaanite, etc., etc. In other words, right up front, God said to Moshe, I'm going to take the people out and bring them to Eretz Yisrael. Four verses later, God says, and if anyone will question that it was actually me who sent you, I who sent you, then proof, the sign that I have sent you, will be that 50 days after you leave Mitzrayim, you will serve me on this mountain, which we understand is Har Sinai, also called Chorev, and it's talking about the receiving of the Torah. In the next parsha of Vo'era, God clarifies the issue differently, because he's not talking to Moshe now, he's talking through Moshe to the people of Israel. And he tells Moshe to go and speak in his name and say to the people, I am Hashem. I will take you out of Egypt. I will take you unto me as a nation, and you will, and I will become your God. You will take me as a God, as God. And you will know that it is I who took you out of Egypt. And I will bring you to the land that I raised my hand in oath to give to your ancestors, and I will give it to you as a heritage. I am Hashem. I am God. There, it's not, I'll take you out of Egypt, bring you to Eretz Yisrael, and to prove that it was me who sent Moshe, you will have the Sinai experience on the way. Here, we have a better picture of what was supposed to take place, and that was Exodus from Egypt, the Sinai experience, and then coming into Eretz Yisrael. I've said many times, we accepted the Torah with two magical words, Na'aseh v'nishma. We will do, and then we will strive to understand all that you have commanded. We blew it with Eretz Yisrael. Instead of answering with the two magical words that Kalev and Yehoshua used, Alo Na'ale, let's go up. Instead, you asked for a delegation to spy out the land, and even Moshe thought it was a good idea, even though he had different reasons for approving it. And there was a 40-year delay until the following generation went into the land of Israel, and not without its problems of conquest and war and everything that happened since then. But that was our fault. The plan can be summarized by saying, how can you even ask Ma'inyan Shmita Eitzel Har Sinai? Shmita, the laws of the land, are an integral part of everything that Moshe was taught at Sinai and transmitted to us. So why was the Torah given at Sinai? To make sure that Jews who in any time in history find themselves not in the land of Israel still know that they have to keep the Torah, at least that part of the Torah which does not require the land. But you do know, I am sure many of you do, the famous Ramban, Nachmanides, who said that keeping mitzvot in Chutz La'aretz, keeping mitzvot outside of Israel, all mitzvot, is to practice how to do it the right way in Eretz Yisrael. Shabbat was meant to be kept by the Jewish people in the land of Israel. Is Shabbat kept by Jews all over the world? For sure. But the Ramban says, you know why they're doing it? To keep in shape, to know what Shabbat is. And the same thing goes for all mitzvot. The quality of observance of a mitzvah in Eretz Yisrael, regardless of whether it has to do with the land of Israel or not, the quality of performance of a mitzvah is higher than any situation outside of Israel. Now let's add one last thing, and I'll call it a day, even though we didn't get to all the things that I had planned, but we never do. Maybe I'll finish off with a letter to the world from Jerusalem, especially since POTUS, President of the United States, Donald Trump, is coming on a visit, which even today was felt in the traffic patterns because of practicing where he'll be going and how he'll be getting from place to place. But why did I bring that up? That's a letter to the world from Jerusalem. What did I want to finish with? Yes, the promises at the beginning of Bechukotai, before we get to the terrible, frightening tochacha, reproach. Im Bechukotai Telechu, if you will follow my statutes and my mitzvot you will keep and do them, then I will give you plentiful rain and the land will give its yield, and the trees of the field will give their fruit. Where? In Eretz Yisrael. Vishavtem lebetach be'artzechem. Jews in New York and Teaneck, New Jersey, and the five towns, and Golders Green in London, and anywhere else they are, have no promises that things will be good for the proper observance of mitzvot. I have to make it clear, we're not talking about individuals, we're talking about the community. But the Jewish community is promised good things will happen if we keep Torah and mitzvot. And the good things that will happen are here in Eretz Yisrael. Let me finish with the letter to the world from Jerusalem. I've read it in past years. I believe it never gets tired or tiring. It was written as an editorial in a now long defunct newspaper called the Times of Israel back in 1969. Eliezer Wortman wrote it. I had the privilege of getting to know him and seeing some of his other materials. And this should work as chizuk, strengthening for us, and messages to the likes of the President of the United States and his entire entourage of more than 1,000 people, and of everybody in the world. People need to hear this and understand what we're saying and why we're saying it. Let me just say before I read the letter that when it was written, the main audience that was targeted were the non-Jews of the world, specifically Christians. And it needs, if you want to modernize it, to be redone to make sure Muslims listen also. But you will see hopefully feel the power of the letter. Let me add one more thing. Earlier this week, there was a report of bad words between a group of Israeli government representatives and those representing the United States, a working group to hatch out certain details for next week's visit by President. And one of the issues was the fact that the President was planning a private visit to the Kotel, in the sense that he's not allowed to have an official visit, an official government visit. No former sitting, standing president had ever visited the Kotel at all. Only after they were out of office, some of them did. But he'll be the first. But when the Israeli people asked if Bibi Netanyahu could accompany him, they not only said no, they were very nasty about it. They said, why are you even bringing up this issue when the Kotel is not even yours? It belongs to the West Bank. I don't know if you could imagine how that infuriated some of the Israelis that heard that. And then when it was reported, many, many other people were furious. And President Trump's Facebook comment and Twitter and this and that repudiating that particular statement. But the fact of the matter is, and we have to face this fact, the United States of America does not recognize Israeli sovereignty over any part of Jerusalem. It has been the case for many, many years, and it's still the case until it changes, that a Jewish child born in Jerusalem cannot be registered for United States purposes at the embassy in Tel Aviv, must go to the consulate in Jerusalem, and is recorded as having been born in Jerusalem. When I, this is 30 years ago, but it hasn't changed to this very day, registered my daughter's birth. We had two daughters who came with us on Aliyah in 81, and a third daughter born in 1986, March 19th. When I went to register her birth at the American consulate in Jerusalem, and one of the documents said place of birth, Jerusalem, Israel, the clerk pulled out a pen, and right in front of me, didn't even wait till I turned my back, crossed out the word Israel, leaving her technically without a state, just being born in a city. So here we have the President of the United States, who has been brave enough to go against previous precedent, and he plans on visiting the Kotel. But it has to be, unless things will change till then, a private visit rather than an official government visit. There is something wrong, and that's what this letter to the world from Jerusalem is trying to address. I am not a creature from another planet, as you seem to believe. I am a Jerusalemite, like yourselves, a man of flesh and blood. I am a citizen of my city, an integral part of my people. I have a few things to get off my chest. Because I am not a diplomat, I do not have to mince words. I do not have to please you or even persuade you. I owe you nothing. You did not build this city. You did not live in it. You did not defend it when they came to destroy it. And we will be damned if we will let you take it away. There was a Jerusalem before there was a New York. When Berlin, Moscow, London, and Paris were miasmal forest and swamp, there was a thriving Jewish community here. It gave something to the world which you nations have rejected ever since you established yourselves, a humane moral code. Here the prophets walked, their words flashing like forked lightning. Here a people who wanted nothing more than to be left alone fought off waves of heathen would-be conquerors, bled and died on the battlements, hurled themselves into the flames of their burning temple rather than surrender. And when finally overwhelmed by sheer numbers, and led away into captivity, swore that before they forgot Jerusalem, they would see their tongues cleave to their palates, their right arms wither. For two pain-filled millennia, while we were your unwelcome guests, we prayed daily to return to this city. Three times a day we petitioned the Almighty, gather us from the four corners of the world, bring us upright to your land, return in mercy to Jerusalem, your city, and dwell in it as you promised. On every Yom Kippur and Passover, we fervently voiced the hope that next year would find us in Jerusalem. Your inquisitions, pogroms, expulsions, the ghettos into which you jammed us, your forced baptisms, your quota systems, your genteel anti-Semitism, and the final unspeakable horror, the Holocaust, and worse, your terrifying disinterest in it, all these have not broken us.
They may have sapped what little moral strength you still possessed, but they forged us into steel. Do you think that you could break us now after all we have been through? Do you really believe that after Dachau and Auschwitz, we are frightened by your threats of blockades and sanctions? We have been to hell and back, a hell of your making. What could you possibly have in your arsenal that could scare us? I have watched this city bombarded twice by nations calling themselves civilized. In 1948, while you looked on apathetically, I saw women and children blown to smithereens after we agreed to your request to internationalize the city. It was a deadly combination that did the job. British officers, Arab gunners, and American-made cannons. And then the savage sacking of the old city, the willful slaughter, the wanton destruction of every synagogue and religious school, the desecration of Jewish cemeteries, the sale by a ghoulish government of tombstones for building materials, for poultry runs, army camps, even latrines. And you never said a word. You never breathed the slightest protest when the Jordanians shut off the holiest of our places, the Western Wall, in violation of the pledges they had made after the war, a war they waged, incidentally, against the decision of the United Nations. Not a murmur came from you whenever the legionnaires in their spiked helmets casually opened fire on our citizens from behind the walls. Your hearts bled when Berlin came under siege. You rushed your airlift to save the gallant Berliners, but you did not send 1 ounce of food when Jews starved in besieged Jerusalem. You thundered against the wall which the East Germans ran through the middle of the German capital, but not one peep out of you about that other wall, the one that tore through the heart of Jerusalem. And when the same thing happened 20 years later, and the Arabs unleashed a savage, unprovoked bombardment of the holy city again, did any of you do anything? The only time you came to life was when the city was at last reunited. Then you wrung your hands and spoke loftily of justice and the need for the Christian quality of turning the other cheek. The truth is, and you know it deep inside your gut, you would prefer the city to be destroyed rather than have it governed by Jews. No matter how diplomatically you phrase it, the age-old prejudices seep out of every word. If our return to the city has tied your theology in knots, perhaps you had better re-examine your catechisms. After what we have been through, we are not passively going to accommodate ourselves to the twisted idea that we are to suffer eternal homelessness until we accept your Savior. For the first time since the year 70, there is now complete religious freedom for all in Jerusalem. For the first time since the Romans put the torch to the temple, everyone has equal rights. You prefer to have some more equal than others. We loathe the sword, but it was you who forced us to take it up. We crave peace, but we are not going back to the peace of 1948 as you would like us to. We are home. It has a lovely sound for a nation you have willed to wander over the face of the globe. We are not leaving. We are redeeming the pledge made by our forefathers. Jerusalem is being rebuilt. Next year, and the year after, and after, and after, until the end of time in Jerusalem. Shabbat shalom, l'hishtameach.